Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hello, everyone. Kevin Cruz here. Welcome to the LeadX Leadership Show, where we help you to become the boss everyone wants to work for. Today in the show, you're going to hear that I got a serious man crush on our guest. I met him a couple of years ago at a New York City dinner, and of course, he doesn't remember me at all. He's super cool. He's a New York entrepreneur. I loved his previous book. And today we talk about the secrets to great teams. And, you know, we ain't talking about that old Foreman, Storman, Norman stuff. He went out and did incredible research and interesting case studies to talk about what really is required to achieve incredible team success these days. We also talk about the power of storytelling and what he does to become a better storytelling writer. But first, how can you use the three-part big model to give someone effective feedback? How do you delegate and not dump a project on someone? How can you use the four D's to get to inbox zero every single day? Learn all this and more from the online learning library known as the LeadX Academy. Start your free trial at leadx.org. Our quote this week, "Talent wins games, but teamwork wins championships." Michael Jordan. You hear that, LeBron James? Takes more than talent to win a championship, so good luck in LA. LeBron James, of course, dissed my Philadelphia Sixers to go to the Lakers. We'll see how that works out. All right. Our guest today is an award-winning journalist. His writing has appeared in Fast Company, Wired, The New Yorker. He's the author of the bestseller Smart Cuts and the co-founder of the content technology company called Contently. He's with me to discuss his new book, Dream Teams, Working Together Without Falling Apart. Our guest is Shane Snow. Shane, welcome to the show.
Hey, happy to be here.
So whoever the guest is, doesn't matter what book they've written or who they are, I always ask some form of a question like, what leadership advice would you give to a first-time manager, you know, a younger manager? And in doing my research, I saw that you, in a Medium article you wrote, you did talk about sort of an adjustment period going from a guy who builds things to a guy who gets other people to build things, which I thought was a great way to talk about management and leadership. So what advice would you give to a younger version of yourself?
Yeah, I had a lot of anxiety around that when, you know, it used to be all on me. And then as a manager, you feel like it's still all on you. The advice that I would give myself is that your job as a manager is not to be the hero. It's not to be the smartest person. It's actually to build and run a team that can be smarter than you. And it's a subtle way of thinking about it differently, but I think it's very important. You know, for a lot of my management sort of history, I would jump in and do things so that they would be done right, which means that I'm actually compensating for a deficiency in either the way I'm managing or who I have on the team. And, you know, and all of the work that I've done in the, over the years, you know, and with my last book, especially on teamwork, becomes very clear that a team is only going to be as good as its smartest and most powerful person, unless you're very deliberate about how you run it. So I would tell myself as a young manager that, and then not to be afraid of making some hard decisions around who actually should be on the team and what efforts you should be making, you know, the less fun stuff of orchestrating things rather than doing things, which, you know, that transition that you talked about. I love creating things. You know, I'm a creative kind of soul at heart. And so when that changed and I had to help other people do things, I wanted to still stay in it. And that actually was a problem.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you sharing that. And it's interesting about the talent aspect because I'm so non-confrontational. Like, I'm not really good at giving people feedback. I'm horrible at firing people, you know, that kind of stuff. But I do think like team leader as coach and a coach who tries to recruit the best players to his or her team. I mean, it does start there with the talent on the team.
Yeah, it does. You know, one of the little diversions I went on, and so I'm not a sports guy. And when I wrote my latest book, Dream Teams, I had to get into sports. One of the things that I found in that research about, you know, what makes for the greatest sports teams and dynasties and all that is often the team captain is not the star. And then you look back at, you know, great leaders in history that we revere, and they're the ones that are, their job is to get the right people on the field and to get them to do the right thing. So I think that's very much in line with what we've been talking about. And it happens in sports all the way to, you know, to running business. But without, so the analogy that I've been using lately, I've been working on it. I didn't really write about this, but if you're making a cake, you're not going to get cake out of 8 different kinds of flour. So it sort of starts there, right? The ingredients, without the right ingredients in the first place, it doesn't matter how you mix them. And that's what you're talking about picking the right people and making sure that you get rid of the wrong people, as hard as that is.
Yeah. And of course, this is all great intro to your new book, which again is Dream Teams, Working Together Without Falling Apart. And so for my listeners who haven't yet read the book, you know, what's the big idea of the book?
The big idea is that there's this paradox when it comes to human beings, which is that when we come together with all of our wonderful different ways of thinking and approaching the world, we either make music and magic and we invent things, we build civilization, or we slow each other down, we have problems, we destroy each other. And you see this at every level, from the smallest partnership to the biggest community and nation. And it's sort of in there is this question, what's the difference between a group of people that can break through rather than break down? So that's what I wanted to explore. And it turns out that a lot of the answers are subtle, and they have to do with psychology, and they have to do with the way our brains are built. And a lot of them go counter to what we're taught in, you know, as kids or, you know, in business school about what it means to getting along versus making progress. And yes, so that's what I wanted to explore in that book.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the key concepts here is cognitive friction. You know, you can't have everybody agreeing with each other and thinking the same way. And to your point, I think a lot of us are raised to sort of, you know, hey, it's all about the team. It's all about the group. It's not about you. Don't push your agenda. And you even touch on, you know, there is a personality aspect of this where, you know, with the Big Five personality model or whatever, there's a personality trait about, you know, am I highly agreeableness? So I'm just going to withhold my own true feelings. I don't want to make anybody upset. Or, you know, people who are lower in agreeableness will be more likely to challenge and push for their views. So, you know, is this kind of inborn and we've got what we're working with, or can we develop this way of like pushing, knowing that this friction is healthy?
Well, that's part of what I wanted to do, is to lay out what it's going to take for all of us to work better together a little bit. Some people are naturally good at being dissenters and rebels and pushing back. And that's something that becomes very healthy if there's a certain degree of that in, you know, on a team and in a problem solving process. But it's, you know, that's not the only thing. You don't want only that. To further the cake analogy, if you have the eggs and the milk and the sugar and all of that, you need to beat them together in order to make cake batter, right? And so you can have all sorts of different people at the table trying to solve a problem together. But if they don't actually sort of, the cognitive friction is the, you know, the psychological word, but if they don't actually mash their different ways of thinking together, then you're not going to get anything more out of it than any of those ingredients. And so that is, you know, some people are naturally more comfortable doing that. And actually something that happens is we're more comfortable doing that around people we feel safe around. Mm. And we feel safe around people that we've known for a long time, that we've built trust, or who are in our psychological in-group, in double quotes, which, you know, is people who look like our family or our tribe, who think like us. And part of what happens in business especially, but in any kind of group dynamic, we want to belong to the team. We don't want to get thrown out of the tribe. And so we will resist, often subconsciously, we'll resist pushing back or bringing stuff up that is going to rock the boat and rock the team unity thing. And then on top of that, we've been taught our whole lives that teamwork and working together is about being unified. It's about, you know, having happiness and love and respect, and all those things are great. But it turns out that that has this negative effect of when you prioritize that sort of like, no, we got to row together, we got to all be, you know, thinking the same thing. You prioritize that over solving the problem, then suddenly you're just squashing out all of the different things that different people can bring, including that dissent, including that disagreeableness, sort of for the sake of helping. And the term I use in the book is comes from Bayard Rustin, a civil rights hero, angelic troublemakers. You know, we need those guys around. But if the angelic troublemakers, who are going to, you know, make trouble so that we can see what we need to see or stir things up, if they don't do that because they don't want to ruin the sort of harmony of, you know, the happy group, then we're missing out on potential there.
Yeah. And I want to come at this from another angle for my listeners out there. You know, one of the great things about this book is that you tell a lot of stories. You've done a lot of research, but you tell a lot of stories. And if we have time, I'll come back to that because I know you worked hard to take your storytelling craft even to a higher level. And so it's a really fun, interesting, engaging book. And when you're talking about all these issues, you know, we're sort of just conceptually talking about them, you actually spend quite a bit of time talking about the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yes.
So for my listeners who have no idea who or what the Wu-Tang Clan was, tell us about the Wu-Tang Clan and how they fit into the work that you were doing here.
So they were one of the anchor stories for one of my chapters, specifically actually the chapter about cognitive friction. I wanted to profile a group of people who, by all means, should not have worked out. And they did because they applied this principle of cognitive friction. And also to me, the story was fascinating because I grew up in Idaho in country music land. And I don't know much about hip hop still, but I moved to New York almost 10 years ago. And you know, all my friends listen to hip hop. And so I started getting into it. And I'm the most ignorant hip hop guy ever. So I started learning about the history of hip hop. I became fascinated because hip hop itself was built on this principle. It was the battle between the DJs and then between the lyricists and the battle of wits at these parties in the South Bronx that gave birth to this genre of music, and which is pretty interesting. Every week you showed back up with new material. And as I started digging into that story and, you know, what happens when a friendly competition actually pushes, you know, an industry forward, what I found was the best example of that within hip hop is the Wu-Tang Clan, who were this pioneering group in the early 90s. It was nine guys wanting to form a music group, which already sounds like a disaster.
Sounds right? Ridiculous. Totally ridiculous.
Yeah. And they're all kind of alpha, you know, and they were these individual rappers with very different styles of music and just very different. You know, one guy used all these cooking metaphors and one guy was really emotional. Another was super aggressive. They had all very different ideas of what made for good rap music. And this guy, Robert Diggs, his stage name is the RZA. He kind of got them all together, these guys from the projects, from different rival gangs. And, you know, a couple of them brought guns to the studio or to the meeting or whatever. And he said, look, give me 5 years and work with me and I'll make you number one. And then after that, you know, I'll work with you as individuals. But like, we're going to be a family for 5 years if you follow my program. And his program basically was he would make some music and then you would prepare your rap lyrics and then show up to the recording studio to battle the other guys, and whoever had the best material for this segment of the song, they got it. And that's how you got on the record. And so he channeled kind of this different ways of doing music and this aggression that they had very much toward each other into this kind of battle of music. And what happened is when you mixed all of that together, and he also did this meta thing where he would mix sound effects from like kung fu movies and all of this other stuff. It was this gigantic mashup that, again, sounds like you're going to make something awful. If this was cooking, it would be poisonous. And what came out of it was this type of music that no one had ever heard. And it blew people's minds. And they hustled for a while and they eventually went platinum and they became number one and they became the most influential music group in hip hop history. And it was all built on this principle that, you know, it's okay that we're different. In fact, we're going to channel that and we're going to use that to push each other to get better. And when we combine all these ingredients, what the RZA said is, when steel strikes steel, both blades get sharper. And that was his philosophy. He said, we're going to go at it. And you look at it, all you got to do is Google Wu-Tang beef, and you'll get a million articles in Rolling Stone and MTV of them talking crap at each other, like in the press and like walking out and coming back. And they were like this family that bickered, but that always came back to make music because they knew that they were better together. And it's sort of this, it's not the ideal dynamic for, you know, say a company in like a serious business setting where everyone has to wear suits. But the underlying principle there was that they made each other better by actually engaging with those different points of view and styles and actually having the arguments. And because they felt like they were a family after a while, after they really solidified, it was okay to have those intellectual battles because they knew that they could always come back and be brothers again.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case study, and it's not. And within the music, not so much on the team realm, but within music, I still don't fully understand it. As we're talking here, July 2018, Drake's album is conquered the charts and there's mm-hmm. all these diss lyrics against other artists and the beefs, which it's hard for me to understand like how much is real between the different artists and all that, but it certainly gets a lot of press and publicity and emotion driving everybody's, you know, music and releases. But it's really right now, it seems like, I mean, it's not to the point where it was where they're getting ready to like physically battle.
Right.
But well, it's there's
something
conquering.
Interesting. Yeah, there's something interesting about that. You know, Drake, he was pissed off because he lost basically very publicly a battle with, you know, another rapper. But something interesting about Drake, I think that has very much to do with him being number one, is he, you look at his best songs and over time, his songs get better and better. He's a master of collaboration. He collaborates with artists across genres. I wrote this piece a little bit ago about probably my favorite Drake song right now called Nice for What, where he takes this New Orleans style bounce music and this bounce producer, which is a very different style of music, takes a Lauryn Hill track and he mashes them all together. And then he has 50 references to a million things in the song. And it's the funnest song ever. And he's combining these disparate things and he's not afraid to do that. And he's done that over and over and over again. So I think that itself, you know, there's some tension between these different genres of music that he's playing with. And now there's tension between, you know, him and Pusha T. And then now he's got to diss him back and all of that. You know, at some point, maybe they do. It gets violent and that's not good. But if you stay in that zone where it doesn't get violent, it's just about pushing yourself to be better. That's how innovation happens.
That's great. And we started talking about talent on a team being so critical and, you know, having to make adjustments. And we're talking about these elements of like cognitive friction, also with intellectual humility. So how do we recruit as business people, as team leaders? How do we find talent that has this combination of, okay, they're going to be different, but we know they're humble enough that they're going to be okay if their idea isn't always winning?
Yeah. So it's tough. There's a few things that I can say that is what you're looking for, right? You're looking for people who are going to add to the equation and people who are going to be able to adapt as you need and who can push back when needed and who can, you know, admit they're wrong. And part of it actually starts with the leader and the manager. The manager has to be the first one to be vulnerable, to say, I could be wrong, but they have to set the stage where they're changing their mind too. And that speaking up with something that doesn't work is still okay because everyone's going to be curious and explore it. And then you're going to, if you don't go with it, it's because you've gone over that intellectual territory. You've gotten whatever you can, and then you've returned back to, you know, to the journey. That starts with the leader. But when you're choosing team members, I think optimizing for those two things, for some, are you bringing something different? And then are you humble enough to change? And there's a few things that I've started doing. I'm still doing work on sort of the practical applications for this. But when you're interviewing someone to join the team, we often just look at like the stats, the highlight reel, right? You know, the resume, what was their GPA? What college did they go to? What experience do they have? Do they have the right answers to the right questions? Or if we're talking sports, you know, how many free throws can they shoot?
Right.
You know, all of that. But what we don't look at is the interpersonal dynamics, the way that the things that are in between the lines on that resume. And we also forget that if you're hiring, you know, the 20 people with the best GPAs from Harvard, you're getting smart people, but you're not getting different people necessarily. Mm. So you want to try and discover, you want to unearth what's behind that resume, what's behind that sort of perfect profile that says that someone has had a different journey. And the more breadth you can get, and across, you know, all sorts of dimensions, geographies and generations, and even things that, you know, when we talk about diversity in America, we're usually talking about race, even things like race or your family ethnicity, all of those things play into having a different story. What I like to do in interviews when I'm recruiting is after we're done with the, you know, do you know how to type code or, you know, whatever, I like to talk to people about their story and ask questions like, what do you read? Mm. Or what's your favorite place in the world? Things that start to evoke stories about yourself. You know, what's your favorite place in the world is usually pretty interesting because you start to learn, you know, do they travel? Do they not? Where are they from? Where have they lived? A question I really like that actually starts to get at this humility thing too is what's a time when you changed your mind about something that was really difficult to change your mind about? Because one, you're getting a story about, you know, their past. You're starting to see who they are as a human being. But two, you're starting to gauge their flexibility, their humility. And so those are the kinds of things. And, you know, I'll also ask, you know, what's something you know how to do that most people don't know how to do? And how did you learn it? And can you teach me? Things that are just outside of the right answers and outside of the resume. There's also this component of it where when someone walks in the door their first day as a new member of a team and you've gone through that experience, they already feel like they have permission to be themselves. They know that they're there because you're interested in who they are and the unique things about their story. And so they're going to be more likely to speak up, and you want to reinforce that. But in terms of how do you gauge someone's intellectual humility in general, you know, their willingness to change, you can look for clues, you can look for cues. You know, do they say we more than I? Are they taking credit? Are they giving credit? Those kinds of things. Are they admitting their mistakes? Are they trying to sound perfect? There's also, you know, in terms of personality tests, there is now a test for intellectual humility where you can take this test and see in across several dimensions where you have work to do. And I think this is good for anyone to do. But, you know, you can actually test people to find out. I think that personality tests like, you know, are you what Myers-Briggs type? And some of those I don't really buy into as much. But I do buy into where are you in terms of respect for other people's viewpoints or separating your ego from your intellect? What's your are you overconfident intellectually? And if the answer is yes, there's things that we can do to work on that. Right. But I think those kinds of things are pretty interesting. You know, you can look for proxies in the interview process. You spend time with people, learn their story, but then, you know, you actually take the test. I've taken the intellectual humility test and discovered that the thing that I need to work on is separating my ego from my intellect, which is, you know, I can respect your viewpoint if it's different than mine, but it hurts if I'm proven wrong, even if I'm willing to change my mind, and that actually can get in the way. And so just understanding more about yourself and as part of the interview process, making it very clear that this is important to us in this team. And, you know, not everyone's going to be perfect. Everyone's on a journey. There's stuff that we can do. But someone who doesn't behave in that way, who's unwilling to change, who's unwilling to respect, who makes things personal, who when there's a debate about an idea, they turn it into, you know, a debate about a person. They use logical fallacies so that they don't lose. That's stuff that as a leader, you need to be able to identify and call out and coach people. Or, you know, if they're not going to change in time, they don't think that this is important, then you need to get rid of them.
Now, you have an enhanced version of the intellectual humility assessment, right?
I do. Yep. It's on my website, shanesnow.com/IH.
You're being so humble there. I was just waiting for you to plug that link like three times as you're talking about, hey, you can take this assessment on it. I had to pull that link out of you.
What's cool about that is, so the intellectual humility thing is brand new. Like the concept's been around forever, but the assessment is brand new in terms of academically approved. I combined that with the openness to experience assessment, which has been around in personality psychology for a long time. That one is basically, are you willing to try the pickle flavored ice cream? Are you willing to travel somewhere you've never gone? That doesn't mean you're open-minded. That means you're open to new experiences. But if you're open to new experiences and you can change your mind and you can respect other viewpoints and you can be okay if someone disagrees with you, those combined paint a pretty good picture of open-mindedness. And I think that that's pretty powerful. So that is what I ended up putting together and drawing some correlations between, you know, a big survey that I did with that sort of double study and data on how people have lived their lives, where they've lived, how they've changed their minds on things, everything from religion to politics to reading habits. And there's a lot of work to be done, but some really cool stuff out of that that I got excited about around the more you learn broadly, you know, the more intellectually humble you'll become, which is cool, but also fiction, it turns out, was a big surprise. That reading lots of novels is basically teaching your brain that about other people who aren't like you and training your brain to respect those other ways of living, which actually does transfer to perhaps a debate with someone in your work about something that, you know, might be valid to see things from another point of view because you've been reading a lot of fiction. So there's stuff like that that's really cool that's come out of that. So yeah, I mean, everyone who listens to this or watches this should take the test and help build the data set so we can learn more, but you can also learn about yourself.
I was going to say, it's a double. I mean, it's self-discovery and you are helping the community to build the data set. It's, you know, and drive that research further. And I want to kind of highlight for our listeners to go back to something you said that I thought was really interesting. You know, this concept of as a leader, having an organizational culture of psychological safety so people can, you know, feel comfortable expressing themselves, sparring. But you said something interesting that you can really start that in the interview process. So the more you start to ask these kinds of questions and perhaps start to, you know, exchange ideas. And if it's a high level hire, you may have more than one interview experience to do this with the candidate. But then on day one, they already understand you as a leader, you know, and the culture they're going into. And it starts that safety right away, because that can be hard to build. People are always so on guard at first, not knowing what the rules, the unwritten rules are, where they're working.
Of course. Yeah, well, and power dynamics are really interesting, right? In the workplace, you come in and you're new, you have very little power, and it's very easy for your power to get taken away. And what you want to do as a leader is you want to set people up so they feel like they do have power to add to the conversations and the debates and the problem solving and to contribute, not just to slot in. And there is this very pervasive kind of thing in our psychology, and certainly in an American business culture, that says you got to do things the way that they're done here. And we'll even come out and say that's not how things are done here. And that stuff basically makes people feel unsafe to speak up when they see something that's different or they have something that could add that is different. And you want to start as early as possible getting rid of that idea that fitting in the groove is not what we're looking for. You know, it brings up a question of, well, how do you be unified if you have, you know, this sort of amount of freedom and leeway? And that's where I think it's important to talk about purpose. And in that interview process, you want people who buy into the purpose of what you're doing, the mission of what you're trying to accomplish, not how you're trying to get there, because the strategy should change. And they hopefully are coming to be part of that changing strategy to help you think a little differently. But you want people to be so on board and devoted to the purpose and the story of what you're trying to do that it further reinforces that idea that, hey, you're here and it's safe to think different and to help us push forward, even when it's uncomfortable. And because what our goal is higher than this. And I think that that's an important piece of the equation that, you know, that can get left out. A lot of times, you know, these a group of people who do see things differently and are willing to fight and you know, fight well or not get along well and all of that, they don't make that much progress either because someone's holding back or because, you know, they're staying stubborn or because they don't know where they're going. And I think back to the Wu-Tang Clan, they had this very clear sort of vision laid out by the RZA, which was, we're going to create this dynasty that changes hip hop music. And here's the timeline. And here's how we're gonna roughly get there. But we're going to change the way that people think about this music. And that is much more important than who gets the most airtime on this record. And don't worry, if we're all in this together and we all like serve the family first on that mission, then afterwards, hey, I'm going to produce your records and you'll be a star on your own. And that happened to all of those guys. So I think that's something that starts early too.
Yeah, that's tremendous. I'm sure everybody listening to me, like, I genuinely love the book, love the stories, learn from it. You want to know what my favorite part is, though?
What?
The epilogue.
Thank you.
I won't get into it on this chat, but I will say, you know, for our listeners, like, the epilogue alone is actually like well worth the investment in the book. And you know, you take a personal turn and you get really vulnerable. You sort of channel your inner James Altucher, you know, like going to not the best version of you and putting it out there as a way to get into some thanks and gratitude. And it actually emotionally touched me and had an impact on me because we met once at one of Dory Clark's dinners in New York City. That was probably a couple of years ago at this point. I can't remember exactly.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, at least. And do you remember anything from that night? I'm curious if you even remember that.
Vaguely. Yeah, I remember the dinner, but vaguely. Yeah,
right. So there's, I don't know, 8 of us there or something. And Dory, she's been on the show a couple of times. Dory's great. And so I'm very introverted, very socially awkward, very insecure. So now I liked the networking event, but like my memories are more anchored because it was so triggering, you know, for me. And there's like Peter Bregman, great author, podcaster, and he's across from me and he's just so suave and handsome and, you know, all this stuff. I'm across from him. And then Andrew Sobel writes like Power Questions. Again, I'm a fan of his work and he was probably the oldest one at the table. And you know, he has sort of like a professor vibe and all that.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that I was a hybrid author, you know, traditional and indie. And he like, I don't know, kind of mocked my indie stuff somehow. Like, okay, that's good. Dory, of course, is holding court. There's a couple of people I don't remember that much. But the coolest person at the table, the one I was most awe of, was you. Because, you know, here's all the business types. And I was probably in a suit or something. I don't know. And you're at the opposite end of the table and you're, you know, wearing black and you've got your tattoos and I don't know, you probably had some funky bracelets on or something, you know,
I did.
Right? And you left the table early. You weren't there that long. And your book, you know, Smart Cuts, I think had just come out a little bit before then. Great, you know, great book. And I'm just thinking, man, that is the dude that's got it all going on. He's running his day job. He's running this successful, cool startup. He's got this awesome best-selling business book. He's not wearing a business suit like the rest of us, you know, trying to fit into that crowd. And he's probably going off because he's got some awesome party or some fun place he's going to. Like, I just really, you made such an impression. And then here it is over 2 years later, and I read the epilogue to Dream Teams, where I think a little bit before in time from that dinner, you're talking about how you were really struggling with some issues on a few different levels. And it was just incredible gift to me to remind me the next time I'm in these situations, or just now, like looking across the room and we think somebody's got it all going on and we're all envious and we're also like, we're not worthy. And it's like, we're all human. We all have our ups and downs and our struggles. And when you don't really know someone, you shouldn't just assume like they got it all figured out. And so, you know, I just wanted to be upfront with you on that, like, and that the epilogue really, you know, changed me or reminded me to be a little bit better and different, you know, in these kinds of situations.
Well, I'm really touched by that. I mean, by both of those things. I can't remember exactly when that dinner was, but I mean, it was a couple of years that I was struggling, and it was very hard to write that epilogue, but also that ended up becoming part of my healing process for, you know, just, And also, I don't even know what to say. Thank you. That's, that's so nice of you to say. I think the point is that I wanted to add a personal note to this book that this is not all about business, but that we need each other. And, you know, that's sort of the, you know, giving away the moral of the story of the epilogue is that, you know, working together and picking each other up and helping each other out and being willing to say the hard things and to still sort of show love, even though when we do, that's what's going to get us through hard times in our families and in our personal lives and in business and in our communities. And that's how we're going to, you know, prevent it from going to war. Right. And I think all of it ties together. But I think you're right. Like I'm always drawn to the sort of the flaw story, right? Like I don't like Superman. I like Batman because he's tortured. And when you learn, you know, that he lost his parents and he's not just this billionaire, that he's got issues like that, that's humanizing. And I think we all have that. And, you know, maybe I inadvertently did a little bit of that in the epilogue, but I wanted to give a thank you to, you know, a couple of the people that really helped me out that were part of my dream team. But it's very, very flattering and humbling to hear you say that. Thank you.
So, you, again, have all kinds of cool bonuses and things for readers, and you wrote sort of a behind the scenes of the pain and the process of putting together a book. And I was hoping you could share a little bit about, like, I'm a big believer in the power of storytelling, and obviously you are too. And so I know you wanted to do some work to take your storytelling, your writing abilities to the next level. What did you do?
I wanted it to be cinematic, right? And some of the best feedback I got from my first book and from some of my more popular articles was about how it felt a little bit like a movie. And so for years I've sort of done this nerdy thing where I'll actually diagram out, you know, my favorite episodes of TV and, you know, my favorite articles. I love this guy Gene Weingarten, who's a Washington Post writer, that you know, I'll just sort of diagram out his articles. How did he structure this? And I've done this with J.J. Abrams movies and episodes for years, and John Ronson is another favorite one of mine. But I wanted to kind of take these different to study and understand different templates for how you weave a story. You know, I found the characters, I have the principles I want to talk about. How do I make it entertaining? How do I make it so that even if you don't care about any of this stuff, you'll still have a good time? And so kind of cribbing from other great storytellers, but I wanted it to feel cinematic. I wanted it to be woven together so that if you were seeing it on a screen, it would still be fun. Because these are topics that they're serious enough, and especially if you're buying it for business purposes, business books can be boring, and I wanted to be the opposite of that. So that was from a structure standpoint, that was part of it. The other thing that I'd say on that front is for feedback from readers. You know, I had an editor, I had a few editors I worked with, but when I asked people to read for feedback, and I even did some of this digitally, I just basically asked them to mark the parts that they got bored. And that is so much more helpful than having people try and guess a better way to, you know, to write it. I'm the one that has all the material, and I have an editor and who has, you know, all the material too. Like, we have a lot that we can work from. We can figure things out, and ideas are welcome. But just tell me where it gets boring. Tell me where it gets boring and mark all those parts, and you get enough people to do that. And then you realize what's working and what's not. And then, you know, what's getting in the way of the message, you know, when the story actually is getting too long, or when, you know, there's not enough story, or, you know, there's too much sort of boring stuff, then you step back and you restructure. And I had this whole process of sticky notes everywhere and rearranging stuff. And so I'm sort of rambling at this point. But to me, I wanted the stories to be the vehicle for the message that I think people should care about. But the best vehicle for that is going to be a story that's entertaining, that hooks you, that ends on a cliffhanger. You know, J.J. Abrams does all of this stuff all the time where you get the first minute of some terrifying action scene and you're like, what's going to happen? And then he says 3 months earlier, you know, those kinds of things to get people hooked to, you know, the mystery of what's going to happen next. And then in order to get to that, you have to learn about a little bit about human nature that's going to maybe help you in business. That was kind of the strategy.
I like Abrams and what I see that technique also is the Breaking Bad series. You know, like it would just open with some ridiculous scene. Like, what are they doing? How did the underwear get hanging off the side of the car? And then it goes back to
that
explain
pilot.
It. Yes, it's so the pilot, good. Right.
I diagrammed out the pilot of Breaking Bad one time because, it was such good storytelling.
Yeah, it was literally textbook storytelling. Phenomenal. Shane, tell our listeners how they can find out more about you and Dream Teams.
Just my website, shanesnow.com. You can get the book there. You can get to that intellectual humility assessment. You can contact me. So, yeah.
Yeah, we'll put that link in the show notes, in the articles, and social media. Shane, thanks for coming on to the LeadX Show.
Kevin, thank you so much.
Friends, if you like this episode of the LeadX Leadership Podcast, please take just a minute and leave a rating on iTunes or Stitcher. It's the number one way we will attract new leaders. And you know, I'm on a mission over the next 10 years to spark 100 million new leaders. And if you're looking to teach your managers how to become great leaders, how to increase their employee engagement scores, and how they can achieve extreme productivity, check out the LeadX Academy at leadx.org, or just send me an email if you have 10 or more managers, and we'll talk about doing a free pilot in your company. info@leadx.org is the email address, and I'll personally respond. Remember, leadership is influence. You are always leading. How will you lead today?